World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. As a boy and living at Glenelg, Ron George always liked mucking about in boats. There was work to be done too, though, and he qualified as a welder, working first in automotive assembly and then for Kelvinator, where he welded kerosene refrigerators. The call of the sea remained strong, so at 17 he enlisted in the Royal Australian Navy in what he admits was a mood driven by both his love of sailing and his sense of patriotism.
Oh, yes.
What were your sentiments? Why did you enlist?
My father went to the First World War at age 17, and I asked him about it, and they agreed, yeah. So I did. But I had to fight like hell to get out of the Kelvinators because they turned to making munitions. And I eventually got out.
So that was a reserved occupation?
Yes, it was, yes.
Okay. You were 17, you joined the Navy. Why the Navy?
Well, I lived at the beach and I was fascinated. I used to have a yacht too. And I think that was probably the incentive, yeah.
Was it hard to get in? I know a lot of blokes went to the Army. Did you have to argue your case?
Yeah, it took time. Yes, it did. And eventually I got in. And
you were posted. I understand you were asked to volunteer something special.
We were stood up by a commander, and he just said, "You lot, step aside, yep, and you're volunteers." And that's all there was. And of course, 17, we went along, and then we caught a train and we ended up in Queensland at a place called Caboolture. Caboolture's quite a holiday resort today, but then those days it was nothing there at all. But it was just a great surf beach for training. Yeah.
I like that because you're always told in the forces never volunteer for anything. You were told you were a volunteer.
Yeah, we were told we were volunteers. Yeah. And we ended up in tents, and mosquitoes were terrible. And someone suggested burning cow manure, and so we did. There's a hell of a stench, but it worked.
Okay. So you were training at Caboolture, now famous as being part of the Sunshine Coast up in Queensland. And what was the big secret? It was a special operation. What were you being trained for?
Well, we were trained to become coxswains and crews of landing barges.
Right.
And we didn't have any barges at them. We were just marching them backwards and forwards on the beach until they arrived. Then we just trained on those inter-surf beaches. Then we had troops come in, mostly Americans.
I've seen so often the surf crews belting their way through the surf. You had these barges,
yeah,
and you had to handle very rough, very challenging conditions. What was that like?
Initially, we were trained on LCMs, which were they carried tanks, and we were taken out into the ocean itself, where there's quite a current, and we had to reverse them at speed. And if you swung off course, you lost it. I was a natural, and I just kept it up, and I became a coxswain.
Good on you.
And then these smaller landing barges arrived, LCPs, LCVs, and they carried 36 troops. And we had to train on those, landing on beaches in surf and back out in surf. And that was quite difficult. Then the American troops arrived, and they housed in tents also. And then we trained them. They must be heartily sick of it because we did it day after day after day. So are we heartily sick of it, yeah.
Pretty rugged stuff. How did you relax? Was there any time off to get a bit of leave, a bit of R&R, anything like that?
No, nothing like that, no. We just played cards and whatever.
Yes, you've said in your memoirs that there were long days of monotonous training, but then the big show was on, the end of 1943, flotilla of American destroyers moving up to New Britain, and you were part of this.
Yeah, that was a strange one, because the first landing we did was with American landing barges and American troops, and we were surrounded by 16 American destroyers. We went into Arrowy. It was a diversion tactics to kick up a hell of a mess to get the Japanese to come up and make an opening down below for the real landing to occur. And it worked, yeah.
So this was active service, it was an operation. How dangerous was it, Ron?
That wasn't very dangerous, this particular one, because it was landing on a quiet area. And it was to divert the Japanese troops away, and it worked, yeah.
How did you get on with the Americans? What did you think of them?
On board ship, they were a wonderful mob. But on ashore, no, they were enemies.
There's a little story about that a bit later we might come to, after the war. But they were your allies, your loyal allies during the war. And then after this diversionary operation, shall we call it that, there was more training, and then another major operation, I believe.
Yeah, what was the next one?
Well, I understand that you're talking about using your own landing craft and carrying American troops to Hollandia.
Yeah, we were involved with the American 7th Fleet from then on, and we had our own landing barges, and I had a W-11, which was an LCP, which carried 36 troops, and they were on derricks on the HMAS West Australia, which were lowered down, and then the troops, we carried 2,000 American troops, and they would scramble down the nets, and then we'd take them ashore, but with Americans, they had American destroyers, and they just built a shit out of the, the landing plant. The trees were left with no limbs on top at all. They just blasted. And then when we landed, we were virtually okay, except for the odd sniper, and they were a menace. But I can remember one sniper on a hill, and the American cruiser come in and blew the top of the hill. They don't mess around, yeah.
A couple of things there we should explore a bit. First of all, LCP. What does that mean exactly?
Landing Craft Vehicle.
LCV.
Landing
Craft Vehicle, okay. Yeah. And then you mentioned, of course, that your mother's ship was the Westralia.
Yes.
A famous craft in Australian history. Tell me a bit about the Westralia, what it was like travelling on her, her origins.
Well, it was a cruiser, then it was converted to a landing ship to carry these, but it carries 16 landing barges, mostly LCVs, but then they had LCMs, which were larger vessels. They had twin grey marine diesels, and they're quite powerful, and they carried tanks, these were lifted off onto the LCMs, and they take those ashore as well. Yeah.
So you're a big target. Was there a constant danger of submarine attack, torpedoes?
Well, when we carried American troops, they really had cover.
I got you.
And they had aircraft, but mostly destroyers, and they were on target all the time. Yeah.
Okay. Then you talk later, I understand, in your memoirs, about travelling a vast distance to the Philippines.
Yes. I can remember the first landing we did was at Panayan. That was one of the islands at the southern end of the Philippines. And all the Filipinos came out in boats to welcome us. And it's an interesting one. They gave us a pig, a small pig, and it was very small. And the captain permitted us to keep the pig on board, and we kept it on the world deck, and we oil it every day because of the heat. And that, and while we had that pig on board, we were never hit, never hit. And it grew to 300 pounds, which is over 100 kilograms. And then we came down to Brisbane to for R&R arrest. The customs realised we had a pig on board off and killed it. And, whoa, we were absolutely devastated. And in fact, a lot of the guys went off and beat up the customs physically. Then when we went off, the first thing we were hit with a hara-kiri. Yeah, it was amazing. But the pig was, while we had the pig, we weren't touched. Yeah.
So the pig was a symbol, if you like. It almost seemed to be a protective influence to you.
His name was Dennis.
So you said that after leaving Brisbane then, you were on your way elsewhere.
Yeah.
And you suffered attacks.
Yeah.
Air attacks.
Yeah.
Can you take me through that? What was it like to have the kamikaze?
Well, I was at the stern and a friend of mine was on a Bofa right at the stern. And I can still see the face of that Japanese coming down. Yeah. And he hit the stern of the ship, and my friend who was on the Bofas, he got a distinguished medal for his guts. I just simply shit myself because I could do nothing. Just watch and I just lay flat on the deck. Yeah,
and you survived.
Yeah, it was.
And I understand this was a repeated menace, if you like.
Oh yeah. We were covered mostly by American aircraft carriers, and when the Japanese came in, the Americans are so well trained, they just blasted them out of the sky. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you made a number of landings with your craft from the West Australia. Talk me through some of those, getting the Americans on board, getting them onto various islands, famous islands in the progress of the war.
Yeah.
What operations in particular do you remember from those times?
Well, Hollandia was one that was quite outstanding and until eventually we went to Borneo, and that was with Australian troops. Then we were in Australian cover, Shropshire, but Australian warships.
Yeah.
But we went to Luzon in the Philippines with Americans. And that was when HMS Australia was there. And the Japanese decided they wanted to get rid of HMS Australia. And the hara-kiris came in low, straight over the West. We thought they were going to hit us, but we went straight over us and hit the West Australia five times. And she, they had quite a loss of life. And she keeled over, but she still led the fleet out. It's quite amazing.
And after all that, you were then dispatched on to Australia to a number of actions in Papua New Guinea and the campaign there.
Yeah, yeah.
Famous names, Milne Bay, Ley, Burna.
Yeah, we did. Well, we seemed to cover the whole bloody Pacific.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk me through that.
Oh, it was just one after the other. It was just repetition. I can remember going ashore at the first time, and when we first went to there, we got a coconut, and I posted at home, and it actually got there. So, yeah.
And in New Guinea with these landings there, how hazardous were they?
They weren't too difficult. There were barriers on all the beaches, and these divers had to go ashore and blow them up so we could land. And when we'd land, invariably there were snipers. They were the biggest fear. But there was no other troops there at all, because they were just blasted out by bombers, American bombers, and warships. And it made it quite safe, yeah.
Okay. You would have clearly have established close friends, like esprit de corps. What was this sort of companionship like? You were sailing together on a big ship, constantly in action. Take me through the feelings you had about this spirit of surviving and going to win the war.
Well, in Moratai, for example, the Americans had a huge barge, and that was loaded with beer, American beer. And we found out, and so we'd sneak out in our landing barge alongside, bust the lock and pinch crates of beer and take them back. And all our landing barges had carbon dioxide fire extinguishers. And we found out if you put a paper bag over the end of the fire extinguisher and turned it on full bore, you'd create dry ice. And we'd just put the beer in that cold and drink it. And we'd make a whole bloody mess of ourselves.
That's companionship for you.
It was, yeah. And, yeah, but some of the others used to play card games and they'd make a lot of money. One guy ended up getting up buying a hotel when he came back. He'd made so much money out of the Yanks. Yeah.
What about souvenirs?
Souvenirs. In fact, I used to own a yacht at one stage, and I went ashore at I'm not sure the land, one of the islands in one of the places in New Guinea, and I got a Japanese parachute that was made of silk. And when I got back, eventually after the war, I built the sails out of silk.
Beautiful. Yeah. So this was constant action. War was coming towards a close. Japan surrendered August 1945.
Yeah.
How did you hear about that? Where were you?
We were a place called Treasury Island.
Yeah.
And it came over the radio that the war had ended. And we went ashore, and we just played games, football, and plenty of grog. And we just celebrated. Yeah. We took photographs of the ship. It was all in colours. Yeah. But prior to that, we had the Borneo landings.
Yes.
And they were, that was a different set of circumstances. They were American, Australian troops and Australian warships. Yeah. And the different attitude of the Australians, they were seasoned fighters, and they were so casual going into the beach, where Americans were tense. Yeah.
That's the most instructive observation. I should perhaps spend a moment or two on the Borneo landings, a very significant event.
Yes.
Paint that picture for me now. You spoke before about the attacks, about the snipers, then about the contrast in the attitude of the troops. Describe the scene for me, could you, and how you felt at the time?
It was quite a pleasure taking Australians in, because one of them even had a flask of tea, a cup of tea going in. I mean, that's how casual they were. Americans, they were absolutely nervous and quite scared, obviously. But we'd done so many landings and the Australian troops reflected on us, and we become quite casual too, yeah.
And was it hazardous?
Not really. The landings were the same. Snipers were the trouble. They caused some problems, yeah. And the West Australia had a medical officer on, and we'd take people that are badly wounded back to the ship, and a Dr. Guest, I can still remember his name, and he'd operate on them, and we'd take American troops and the Australian troops back to the ship, and Americans are coming and saying, "Help me, help me, help me." They're quite distressing, and they were badly wounded, and some of them lost limbs, and that was quite difficult, And the Australians the same,
But the attitude of the Australian troops when you were taking them in, these were battle-hardened men, weren't they?
They were, Ninth Division, And they'd been through it all, And some of them come back from the Middle East.
Exactly.
Sure.
Most interesting reflection there on attitudes, and you've painted a really vivid picture. Thank you for that. But the war was over. August 45, it was over. What were your hopes then? Did you just want to get out of the Navy, or did you want to sail some more? What did you want to do?
We were all offered to go to the to Tokyo for the signing of the peace, and I was offered it too, and I'd had enough. I'd had 4 years, and I was nearly just turned 21.
Yeah.
And I said, to hell with it, I'm not enough. So I got out. I left,
But there was one more little bit of excitement for you. You got to Sydney and a little bit more of biffo.
Well, we used to train physically. And I wasn't very big, but I was with some big guys. And we're on leave. And there were five of us. And there were five Americans coming towards us. And the other guys just said, "She's on." It was on, but there were two hits. They hit me, and I hit the ground.
Oh, dear.
And I went into Balmoral Hospital, and that was a naval hospital then. Yeah. And I had both jaws wired together.
Right.
And I can remember, and I'd go ashore, and I could just have liquid foods, and I spent 2 months there, and then. I coming home one night and somebody shifted a flower pot, and I walking into my room and I hit this flower pot and blah! And of course I busted all the bloody wires, and so they had to do it again.
What sparked it? I mean, was it perhaps Americans getting Australian girls and having more money? Was that the sort of that was why it was on?
I think they say They had plenty of money, and the girls attracted to them because of their money.
Sort of amount.
They had a ball.
So post-war was a bit traumatic for you. You survived without a scratch.
Yeah.
During the really heavy action, and then you got laid out by American ally. Okay, after the war. So we're into the end of 45. Early, after all these adventures at Balmoral Hospital, we must be into 1946 by now.
Yeah.
You got back to Australia, came back to Adelaide, discharged from the forces.
Yep.
What were your ambitions?
In the Riverland, we heard they were offering a trainee scheme for World War II veterans. And we went back to Adelaide, this John Stratford and myself, and we asked about it, and they said, yes, they were considering trainees. And would we like to go back and interview growers to see whether they'd be willing to take us on? And we went back, and the idea the growers would pay one quarter of the wage, and then the government would pay the other three quarter, and then it would gradually come down every 6 months. Nobody was interested. We went to Wake Room. We met a George Burns, and he wanted to know what we were doing, and we told him, and he said, I'll talk to a Major T.G. Hemming.
Right.
And I know, we'll organise it. And he said, you can go back and tell them there is a job available for both of you. And then we told them, and we come back, and we went to a little shack called Mrs. Carter, and she had turned out ordinary rooms in division into four, just to make money.
You're going to be part of a soldier settlement scheme, in a sense, even though you're a sailor.
Oh, that's right. We worked for a guy called Andrews, and he was a good trainee, trainor, and then we were interviewed, and eventually we were, according to our ability, we were selected. And I was able, because I work with Andrews, I won printing competitions, and I got my first choice. And so we went to Loxton.
Yes.
And Loxton was just farming lands, and we turned it into a fruit grower.
So you received some solid training in how to grow.
5 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the great criticisms of the post-World War I scheme was that men were just dumped there without proper training.
Sure.
You were obviously trained.
Well trained. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
What sort of fruit are we talking about here? What variety? What varieties of fruit are we talking about here?
I worked at Wakery on carrying all different fruits, and I had a horticulture advisor called Bill Pollitt.
Right.
And he said, when you select a block, make sure you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Get multiple ones. So we ended up with currants, sultanas, gordos, which are lexias, pears, peaches, citrus, the whole lot. I had 16 different varieties. And actually, eventually, we found out that was wrong. So I ended up with all citrus. So if you got all your eggs in one basket, you can take care of them. And so that's what I did. I finished up with all oranges.
You had a highly successful life up there. You're a prominent citizen. Obviously, love the place.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful, yeah.
I think we should talk about the next important thing in your life. That's you got married.
Yeah. I met my wife at Wakery, Beryl Tyndale. And she was teaching history, English. And I was half drunk one night walking along a brick wall, and I fell over and fell into her arms. That literally happened. And we started going out together, and we played tennis together, and she played netball, and I played basketball, and eventually we went to Loxton together. And I introduced her as my future wife. And that's helped also with the selection of the property, because we were one of the youngest couples there.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Most of them were ex-fruit growers, and yeah, they were much older than we. Mm.
A long life of much achievement up there.
Oh, yeah.
So I understand. Mm. I also understand that you developed a number of specialities of your own, in that you won a Churchill Fellowship, is that correct?
Yes, I did. That was Norman Tyndale. He was also an entomologist.
Right.
And on the citrus property that we ran, he found this little wasp called Bifasciata. It was a little black wasp,
right.
And we were spraying the trees with malathion, and that's a nerve poison. Mm. And he decided that if we hung the fruit in the trees, let the parasite attack it, and then gracefully extend it over the orchard, and we refused to spray them. It was compulsory to spray them, but we didn't. And eventually I met up with a Dr. Noel Richardson at the research centre, and he was breeding another parasite called Aphytis malinus. And I was also acting, I did so many things. I worked as a horticulture advisor, and that was run by Cresco Fertilisers. And they come out with high analysis fertilizer, but it wasn't accepted because it was too early. And they had money to spare, so they built this insectary and built it on my property. And the first year we had it, it worked very, very well. And we had properties, we went to properties in Victoria and New South Wales. And but they used to come to our property to have a look at the insectary, and it worked so efficiently that it took off. And I was driving to properties in Narendra, Leeton, Griffiths, and I'd taken about 5 or 6 hours. And so I decided to become a pilot. So I did training at Wakery an hour every week. It only cost $25 an hour then. It's a yes. bit more expensive today. And then we had an aircraft, and it'd take an hour and a half to get there. And that was the difference. And I could travel much further and quicker. Yeah.
That is a terrific achievement. What do you think about it? You go right back to your early days, riding a bike as an office boy, running messages, then a coxswain landing craft. Then you turn to the air. You've done the lot.
Yeah, we covered the lot. Yeah.
What sort of aircraft did you fly?
Piper Arrow.
Piper Arrow. Well done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who owned the aircraft then?
Well, the Loxton Group, there were 11 of us.
Yeah.
And they owned it, and we'd hire it. And then as costs become increasingly too much, they get steadily dropped off until there were only 3 of us left. And it became too expensive to maintain, so we had to get rid of it, and I went back to driving.
Yeah. Now, let's spend a moment more on this insect. How beneficial were these tiny wasps? What exactly did they do?
Well, originally they were fumigating the orange trees with tents to kill the red scale. Then they went to chemicals like malathion, parathion and suprathion, and they're nerve poisons. Yeah. And they were doing a lot of damage to the fruit growers, and they were becoming physical wrecks. And their Phytis melanus is a little wasp. It's a millimetre. It's as big as a pin's head.
Yes.
And we used to manufacture and put about 300 in little capsules about as big as your thumb.
Right.
And we'd hang those on the third tree in every third row. The little wasp would emerge. They'd attack the scale immediately, lay eggs in the scale. The eggs would develop to a pupa, and the pupa would eat the scale. Then they'd develop and just multiply. But heat and frost would decimate them. So that's why we had to keep going. But also, as it got known, it increased. And we were the only ones in Australia. And then other people learned what we were doing, and they came in and started to copy us. Yeah.
So the name is the Phytis. Could you spell it for me?
Aphytis, A-P-H-Y-T-I-S.
Aphytis?
Melinus, M-E-L-I-N-U-S.
Thank you.
Melinus. Aphytis melana.
Still going to this day?
Yeah, it is still going. I sold it after 16 years to another fellow, and he's still going. Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
Tremendous life of achievement in the Riverland, after all you'd seen in the war. Yeah. To the extent that not only were you doing all these wonderful pioneering things in primary production, but your wife Beryl was achieving a number of things of her own.
She never stopped. She was a workaholic. She became the Citizen of the Year, a Riverland Citizen of the Year, a rural legend because of her attitude. She was a president of TAFE. She was in the Women in Horticulture. She just never stopped.
Yeah. Master of Arts thesis.
Yeah.
Incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And you had a family?
Got three kids. The first one was Sanya. She's the smallest. Then there's Karen. She's a PhD. And then there's Gary, and he's an actor, a Shakespearean actor.
What a tremendously colourful family.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm living in retirement now. Many things to reflect on. But I notice you haven't stopped. You've got your computer and your email, and you're in touch with the world. Looking back on the war, would you do it again?
I think I would. Yeah. There are a lot of hazards and scary. I joined the Navy because it was a great adventure and didn't turn out that way. It turned out to be very difficult. Yeah, I'd do it again, sure. Yeah, because I met my beautiful wife. This year we've been married 68 years. Yeah. And unfortunately, she developed Alzheimer's and advanced Alzheimer's. She's in Harndorf Residential. She's been there over 2 years. She's in a comfort chair. She cannot speak, but she smiles at everybody. Yeah. But I've become part of the place, yeah.
Visiting,
yeah. Yeah, I run a vegetable garden and teach bingo and all sorts of things, yeah. And help a lot of the ones that are quite hopeless, yeah, help them around, yeah. But I quite enjoy it, yeah.
We're recording this interview, as I said right at the start, on the 24th of October. It's not far off the 11th of November, Remembrance Day. What do you remember on Remembrance Day?
I went to the... Bill Denny became a friend, and he invited me to a reception at the Governor's Place. It was a reception for World War II veterans. And because of shortage of Navy guys, he asked me, would I deliver the ode? And so I sat up there with the governor, and I talked to his wife later on, and I delivered the ode. I'll never forget it. But that was a wonderful experience, a huge crowd, yeah, yeah. But because there's so few Navy guys left South Australia.
Yes, that's it. This was Bill Denny, of course, prominent figure in service organisations. And former head of Veterans SA, this would have been the Government House reception of victory in the Pacific for World War II vets, I believe.
The honour of being asked to deliver the ode, that was amazing. And I felt a VIP, and I'm sitting next to the Governor, and then we had a reception after with his wife. She's a lovely lady.